Finding a Way to Save Face. Today, Wednesday, October 9th. This is The World. The shutdown grinds on, and neither Democrats nor Republicans are budging. That's setting off financial alarm bells around the globe. So how can the standoff end? Can either side find a way to save face? We'll hear how the concept of saving face works in Japanese culture. Also today, a Somali-American imam who went to Mogadishu to denounce extremism. On the way home to Minnesota, U.S. authorities stopped him at the airport.
This is not the first time. This is not the second time. This was not the third, fourth time. This all the time.
And later, 16 and 17-year-olds get ready to vote for the first time in Argentina, and they're planning to show up.
I'm going to try to make the revolution. I mean, you have to try.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Obama today invited top Capitol Hill Democrats to the White House to talk shutdown strategy, but still no talks with Republican leaders, although the White House says they'll be invited later. That's little comfort to the financial world, which fears the paralysis in Washington will lead to the U.S. defaulting on its debt. President Obama tried to send the markets a reassuring signal today. He nominated Janet Yellen to take over at the Federal Reserve. She's currently the Fed's number two and close ally of current chairman Ben Bernanke. So her appointment offers a measure of stability. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, there's still plenty of concern overseas.
The U.S. government shutdown is, well, stupid. Those aren't my words. They're from the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, Oliver Blanchard.
If this went on for another 2 weeks, it would not be a major issue. I think the big event, if it were to happen, is clearly the debt ceiling.
Just how big of an event would it be if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling and the U.S. defaults on some of its financial obligations?
Nobody knows what that would look like, but it wouldn't be good.
Patrick Chovanec is with Silvercrest Asset Management in New York. He's also a former economics professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing. China is nervous, Chovanec says, because Chinese economic growth is tied directly to the creditworthiness of the United States.
There is this notion that China is a big bank, a very powerful bank, and that Europe and the United States and all the other countries go to it and hope that they will be funded. And in fact, China is actually more like a neighborhood storekeeper who keeps on extending more and more credit to his customers because he's afraid that if he doesn't extend more credit, they'll stop buying and he'll have to close up shop.
That might not be the best way to run a business, Chovanec says, but it remains the business model for the U.S. and China, the world's two largest economies. Like China, Japan is sitting on more than $1 trillion worth of U.S. debt. After two decades of economic stagnation, the Japanese economy is finally showing signs of recovery. And Washington's flirtation with the very idea of default is causing concern in Tokyo. Satoru Mori teaches U.S. foreign policy at Hosei University.
You had the sequestration earlier this year, and then we have the government shutdown, and the so-called default crisis is coming. You can understand how the Japanese public will become more worried as these crises occur again and again.
And those worries are about the potential political fallout as well. Take the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example. It's a gigantic new free trade pact encompassing 40% of the world economy, and it would include Japan, the U.S., and much of the Asia-Pacific region. The Obama administration has been working for 3 years on this and wants to wrap up the treaty by the end of the year. But Mori says Japan is losing faith in Washington's ability to do its part.
Even if we conclude a broad agreement by the end of the year, will President Obama be able to push this through Congress next year?
The dysfunction in Washington as it pushes America toward the cliff of U.S. default would have geopolitical ramifications that could be worse than the economic ones, says Xenia Dormandy. She's with the Chatham House think tank in London. The political breakdown has been playing out for a few years now, but Dormandy says this latest episode is adding to the belief outside America's borders that Washington is broken.
And that has huge consequences. It has consequences for authoritarian governments and peoples looking at the American democracy and saying, maybe this isn't the best system. We shouldn't, you know, the Washington consensus isn't something we want to propagate, we want to pursue. It has consequences in terms of the belief that from allies that America maybe isn't as reliable as it once was. And it has consequences for adversaries who say, we can do whatever we want because America is not going to be able to act when push comes to shove.
President Obama was asked on Tuesday if America's overseas friends should be worried about the political meltdown in Washington. He acknowledged that there is concern, but he suggested that as long as this sort of crisis doesn't keep repeating itself every few months, things will turn out fine. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
As President Obama and Republicans continue to dig in their heels over the shutdown, there's a lot of talk in Washington about how to save face. You know, making concessions while guarding some aspect of one's pride or prestige. Saving face is a key concept in many cultures around the world, especially in Asia. Michael McKenna works for Japan Intercultural Consulting. He helps Japanese business people understand American culture and Americans understand the Japanese.
In Japan, one of the earliest written documents was called the 17-section constitution of Shotoku Taishi. And the first phrase in there, the first line of this is, harmony is to be sought, conflict avoided. Saving face are ways of avoiding conflict, making sure that you don't pick fights that will get in the way of the group holding together.
In other words, it really urges compromise.
It recognizes that you don't get towards joint action by taking a hard position early on and not moving towards your partner.
How does it apply today in Japan to finding harmony in business and life?
People avoid direct conflict, avoid direct statements. There's a wonderful word for no in Japanese, but you don't hear the word used all that often. People don't say no. They say, well, it's a little different. Or we're thinking about that, or that might be difficult. And the listener understands that all might be different ways of saying no. There's a great book that was written years ago called 16 Ways Not to Say No that every student of Japanese language just loved to read.
So is this just the Japanese being nice, or are they kind of equivocating and really want to say no, but they don't kind of have the nerve to say no?
I don't know if equivocating is a good way of thinking about it. Putting it in the context of holding the group together, of being able to work with these people the next day and the day after on different issues. If you take a hard position and insist on the purity of your principles, it may be difficult to do work with them on something else tomorrow.
Well, let me ask you to take a flyer then on the politics in Washington right now. So we've got the situation. Things have ground to a halt in the Capitol. Our culture is not like the Japanese culture. But what do you think we could learn from the Japanese about saving face?
The way one gets around it in Japan is by talking in less public ways, exploring what we could each live with. But again, that assumes that there is goodwill on both sides. Both sides do want to reach an agreement.
So the very public press conferences that President Obama and the Republicans, John Boehner, are holding, that's not the Japanese way?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's much more likely that people are going to, way back when, before it hit the headlines, will try and find out what you can live with, how we're going to handle it. It makes for very slow change in Japan. It takes a long time to reach an agreement, but when they do get to an agreement, that's the way they do it.
Michael McKenna works for Japan Intercultural Consulting, helping Japanese people understand American culture and vice versa. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Disgraceful, said Speaker Boehner. Shameful, said Senator McCain. Disturbing, said the president. All three were referring to one aspect of the shutdown, the Defense Department's withholding of benefits that it normally provides to the families of those killed in combat. Four such families were at Dover Air Force Base today in Delaware to receive the remains of loved ones, soldiers killed in a Taliban attack in Afghanistan on Sunday. Normally, these families would get $100,000 from the Pentagon, crisis benefits. The money is meant to cover immediate expenses like the loss of a soldier's pay, flights, and funeral costs. they weren't going to get it. But it now seems a fix is in the works. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel this afternoon announced that the government has agreed to sign a contract with a charitable organization called the Fisher House Foundation to cover the death benefits until the shutdown is over. I spoke earlier with Cindy Campbell, the foundation's vice president for community relations. Tell us, first of all, Cindy, what help are you providing?
Well, we are offering the families, we're pledging support of $100,000 per family so that they may have that cushion that they need, that extra money that is exactly what the death gratuity is for. We want to be there to offer that, to bridge that gap in between the shutdown.
And how have the families responded?
Of course, the families are in Dover today. This is a really tough day for them because they're bringing their loved one home. So we have not actually talked to any of the families yet, but we're ready for them when they're ready for us.
I mean, I imagine they'll be really grateful, but probably wishing your services were not needed right now.
Well, we certainly wish that we weren't needed as well. It's a really tough time, and you know, it's really difficult for people to truly understand what these families go through. We've been doing this for many, many years. We have a Fisher House at Dover Air Force Base, where these families stay in a very wonderful, comfortable, peaceful place during this just gut-wrenching time. So, and we've been doing this. We've been offering flights to families for years to get them to Dover. So we hope that we're there. We certainly hope that we're going to offer a little bit of solace to them.
So not everyone may be familiar with the Fisher House Foundation. Tell us briefly what you usually do.
Sure. What we do is we build comfort homes at military hospitals and VA hospitals across the country. We have 63 of them. They're a place to stay for free, much like a Ronald McDonald House. But we also have a Hero Miles airline ticket program where Americans can donate their frequent flyer miles. We've given out over 40,000 plane tickets since this war has begun. It's a huge, huge amount of support that we've given to our families. Many of those families were going to Dover.
When did you hear about this current problem of the families of slain soldiers being denied death benefits, and how did you decide to help?
Oh, absolutely. We knew about it all along. Ken Fisher, our CEO, was well aware of it, but it took a phone call from Senator Manchin. He called and reached out and said, listen, this is what I want to do. I want to see if Fisher House would be willing to bridge this gap.
That's a Democrat from West Virginia?
Yes, Democrat from West Virginia, and I've been a wonderful supporter of our foundation. And, of course, we said yes, absolutely. We will step up and do this for our families, anything that they need.
There have been 17 deaths, I believe, so far among military personnel here and around the world since the shutdown began. Are you able to provide help for all those families?
We're able to. We will help any way we can. This is our pledge. And, like I said, we hope that these numbers do not grow. But, you know, this is a stark reminder for the American public. You know, the war is still going on. It's still going on. I sometimes think people really don't think about it very much. I'm a retired Navy officer. I think about it every day. It's what I do for a living. And, you know, as awful as this is, if there's a silver lining, I think it's that the American public has remembered that we are still at war and we need to help these families.
Cindy Campbell with the Fisher House Foundation, thank you and good luck with your work in the coming days.
Oh, thank you.
Still ahead on the program, how big is a zettabyte and why that may be stumping the NSA on the world from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When news broke of the attack on a Kenyan shopping mall by the Somalia-based militant group Al-Shabaab, people in Minnesota braced for media attention. The state is home to America's largest Somali community, and Shabaab has recruited there. Most people in that community, of course, reject extremism, including the man you're about to meet. Minnesota Public Radio's Laura Yuen has his story.
Hassan Ali Mahmoud is an imam, and it's just one of many roles he's taken up since moving to the U.S. He's also a law professor, a soccer player, the father of seven, and a leader within Minnesota's large Somali community. His Somali nickname means the educated, and for good reason.
I have three law degrees, so that's what made me unique. So
Mahmoud's 51, and he's got a trimmed white beard and wears glasses, and he's never been shy to offer his opinions. But it's only recently that he's gone on a full verbal assault against Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group from Somalia. When I first met Mahmoud years ago at his storefront mosque in St. Paul, he was skeptical of reports that young men from Minnesota were returning to Somalia to fight alongside the extremists. Here's a clip from my first meeting with Mahmoud back in 2008.
If there is any son that was sent to the violence, we need to see the proof.
Mahmoud wasn't condemning al-Shabaab back then. He was staunchly opposing the Ethiopian military troops who'd invaded Somalia in 2006 to prop up the country's weak government. At the time, many Somalis saw al-Shabaab as freedom fighters, defending their land. But as the group continued its extreme violence and aligned with al-Qaeda, Mahmoud says it was soon clear who al-Shabaab was.
This group is dangerous to Islam itself and to us as a people of Somalia, and then to the world people.
Mahmoud believes mosque leaders should help fight radicalization. Last month, he traveled to his homeland's capital, Mogadishu, for a conference tackling extremist ideology. The Somali government invited 160 imams worldwide to strongly state that al-Shabaab has no place in Islam. During the conference, two explosions hit a Mogadishu restaurant, killing 20. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. It's not certain whether the religious conference triggered the attack, but it is clear that going to Somalia for the sole purpose of denouncing al-Shabaab is a risky move these days. Mahmoud knows that.
I told my family, my colleague, the mosque, my friends that to forgive me because there is a possibility that I won't come back.
Now Mahmoud is back, safely, at his mosque in St. Paul. He addresses his flock with a first-hand message from Somalia.
Today what we see, my dear brothers and sisters, from some groups who claim that they are Muslims, we see their behaviors are opposite of Islam, and al-Shabaab is one of them.
Mahmoud reads a fatwa issued at the Mogadishu conference against al-Shabaab. He tells worshippers it's their duty to see that Somali-American youth understand that Islam is a peaceful religion. Mahmoud moved to the U.S. in 1996, 5 years after Somalia's civil war broke out. He says his faith teaches him to protect his American neighbors, even with the risks of denouncing al-Shabaab in Mogadishu. At the same time, as al-Shabaab's terrorism intensifies, so does scrutiny of Somalis in the U.S. Mahmoud feels this himself. Coming back from Mogadishu, he says U.S. customs officials detained him at the airport for extra screening.
This is not the first time. This is not the second time. This was not the third, fourth time. This all the time.
Mahmoud worries about a tighter crackdown if any Somalis who'd lived in the U.S. are linked to last month's shopping mall attack in Nairobi. He says that just after that attack, someone asked him a question that still perplexes him.
Have you ever thought someone from the community, the member of community, would do this type of act here in Minneapolis? I said, nothing is impossible today.
Mahmoud says that's why he preaches to his neighbors, his community, that the vast majority of Somalis here detest violence. But for a holy man whose only arsenal is his words, he says he's just getting started with al-Shabaab. This, he tells me, is war. For The World, I'm Laura Yuen, St. Paul.
Laura's story is part of our Global Nation coverage. Check it out at pri.org/globalnation. You're hearing some of the work of the beat-making lab there. We introduced you to the brains behind the lab last week, Pierce Freelon and Stephen Levitin. They teach at the University of North Carolina, and they travel the world setting up beat-making labs. It's hip-hop meets pretty much every other style of music in the countries they land in. Their latest project is in Ethiopia, and for the next few weeks, they'll be joining us on Wednesdays as they get prepped to head back to Ethiopia to see the progress of the lab. You can see the lab yourselves at PRI.org. The lab is producing a weekly video about their project in Addis Ababa. Pierce Freelon joins me now from WUNC in Chapel Hill. So last week, Pierce, your video introduced us to a young woman named Galila, delightful young woman who's in this beat-making lab. So eventually, will Galila become a music producer, or what's going to happen with her and her music?
you can't learn how to become, you know, an electronic music producer over a 2-week period. You can get an introduction to the craft, and you can begin to build that skill set and nurture those talents. But really, it takes a lifelong commitment to really decide that you want to do music full time. And I definitely think it's a passion of hers. In our latest episode, her dad talks about how she wants to go into production. And, you know, it's an extracurricular piece now that we hope, especially with someone as talented as she is, that she'll nurture that seed that we planted. And, you know, hopefully it will bear some fruit from her later.
Talented, and her writing is really personal and strong. I noticed her friend, also a young woman, her rhyme was really profound, talking about losing her daughter because the clinic was too far away. I mean, those aren't the kind of things we typically hear in hip-hop.
Yeah, that was Marta. And, the poetry. First of all, the poetry scene in Ethiopia and Addis Ababa is absolutely amazing. They're just some of the dopest poets. So I would say, like, probably half the students in that classroom, including Marta, including Galila, could lay down some really profound, dope lyrics. And I'm a lyricist. I'm an MC. So I was really blown away. But, you know, part of our goal with IntraHealth was to try to tap into what some of the youth perspectives on local health issues were. So what we were trying to do with Beatmaking Lab is use music as a tool to kind of open people up, hear from them what the issues are. So with that poem that Marta did that you'll hear a little about in the upcoming weeks, you know, we got to hear what some of the issues were, and it was really touching.
And IntraHealth is the NGO the Beatmaking Lab is working with in Addis. Of course, it's not as easy as it all sounds. I'd like our listeners to hear a moment where things get a little fraught in the sessions.
Some students were unhappy with the song, and while we were running out of time, they were running out of patience.
They're saying you cannot do that.
You can't even tell them that because they may not be cool with it. They're like, you know what, I'm not cool with taking a traditional thing and flipping it.
It's not going to sound like this when we're done with it.
So, Pierce, I mean, you're a professor at UNC. You're also an MC. What kind of music do you make?
I'm in a hip-hop and jazz band called The Beast. Actually, our latest project is called Gardens. It's The Beast plus Big Band, where we take, hip-hop and jazz, and then we make it orchestral. It's like orchestral hip-hop, orchestral jazz.
I'd love it if you took us out today with some of your music from your band, The Beast.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure. This song is The Beast plus Big Band. It's a song called Cost of Living from our upcoming EP, Gardens.
Pierce Freelong, great to speak with you again. We'll catch up soon.
Sounds good, man.
Listen here, saying what they don't want you to hear, seeing what they don't want you to peer. Things are often not what they appear.
You can see the latest video from Beatmaking Lab at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman, ahead, tapping a deep vein of frustration with Afghanistan.
I still don't think that much of the Afghan leadership understands just how tired the U.S. public and government is with this exercise, and how, with what little regret, the United States will walk out the door and not look back.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. 12 years ago this month, American and coalition forces went to war in Afghanistan. And as we mentioned earlier in the program, U.S. forces are still fighting and dying there. The seemingly never-ending battle against the Taliban grinds on. For more than a decade, the Taliban have continued to terrorize Afghans and to undermine the shaky government of President Hamid Karzai. Next April, Karzai is slated to step down, but the candidates likely to succeed him and the electoral process that would put them in place are deeply flawed. So says the Carnegie Endowment's Sarah Chase.
There's a very checkered cast of characters, but I think even more important than the individual names on the list is the sort of smoke and mirrors of the whole exercise. It's not as though there are a number of candidates and then people are going to vote for them and the top two will run off against each other. Sometimes it's sort of like false competition. So the way a single multinational might produce a number of different brands of a certain product, toothpaste, and people feel like there's actually a competition among these different brands, but they all belong to the same guy. So what's happened already is that President Karzai has stuffed, as it were, the so-called Independent Elections Commission. He's appointed an interior minister who controls a significant amount of the pre-electoral process because he controls not just the police in Afghanistan, but also the governors.
Karzai is not running. So are there some candidates who it seems like are going to be the leaders in this election?
I still think that President Karzai will be running the fraud. The question is going to be on behalf of whom. And there are several candidates that are seen by many Afghans to be aligned with President Karzai. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about false competition. You have his older brother, Kayyum Karzai, in the race. You have Zalmay Rasool that President Karzai had suggested earlier on that he's in favor of him. And probably one or two others. And what I believe is going to happen is that at an opportune moment, all but one of these pro-Karzai candidates is going to pull out and sort of throw his block of votes to the last remaining one.
So there's some evidence on the fraud in the 2009 election. How do we know the fix is in right now for this election, as you allege?
I don't know that, but there's no indication that steps have been made to prevent the same thing from happening. And also President Karzai's determined push to put people favorable to him personally on the Independent Election Commission and to prevent there being a similar international, professional international involvement on these two bodies, and to also reduce the powers of the Electoral Complaints Commission, indicate that he's planning to do this.
I mean, the election is also, we got to remember, against the backdrop of U.S. presence in Afghanistan that is quickly winding down. And just this week, we've heard President Karzai lashing out at the U.S., saying Afghanistan isn't really willing to compromise when it comes to a continued U.S. presence and that NATO is to blame for the country's current problems. Here's what Karzai had to say to the BBC this week.
On security front, the entire NATO exercise was one that caused Afghanistan a lot of suffering and a lot of loss of life, and no gains because the country is not secure. I'm not happy to say that, well, there is partial security. That's not what we are seeking. What we wanted was absolute security and a clear-cut war against terrorism.
So, Sarah Chase, Afghanistan's president is saying NATO hasn't done anything of value in the last 10 years. What's he really after here in making that sort of statement? Is he saving face for a domestic Afghan audience?
I think he is saving face. And obviously, there have been a number of errors and significantly misguided policy over the course of the last 11, 12 years. That being said, I'm not sure if his objective is to not have a continuing presence and therefore not have the kind of financial resources flowing into Afghanistan that he seems very interested in continuing to receive, he's going about it the right way. I mean, in a funny way, I think that in his effort to curry favor with some aspects of the Afghan electorate, he's also really overplaying his hand with respect to the United States. I still don't think that much of the Afghan leadership understands just how tired the U.S. public and government is with this exercise and how, with what little regret, the United States will walk out the door and not look back.
I mean, you've been following Afghanistan as closely as any Westerner for the last 10 years, Sarah. Are you exhausted at this point?
I'm exhausted with the United States government, which has just refused over the course of more than a decade to change the fundamental approach to this country. And that means the approach to the kleptocratic governance of the Karzai administration, which the United States has been enabling and which the Afghan population can't stand and against which it's had no recourse on the one hand. And on the other hand, its approach to Pakistan, which has been deliberately fomenting an insurgency in Afghanistan. And until one or the other of those problems is addressed by the United States government, there's no hope for a more positive outcome in Afghanistan. And I frankly know, having been inside some of these debates, that these decisions are not going to be relitigated.
Sarah Chase is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She'll soon have a new book out on how kleptocratic governance fuels religious extremism. It's called No Appeal on Earth. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Marco.
There's an election coming up in Argentina, too. These are very interesting political times in the South American nation. With just weeks to go before the vote, the country's president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, is off the campaign trail. She's recovering from surgery that drained a dangerous blood clot inside her skull. But the upcoming election was always going to make news anyway. That's because for the first time, Argentina's 16 and 17-year-olds will be allowed to vote. The move was seen as a vote grab by the president's party, the Front for Victory. Eilish O'Neill reports from Buenos Aires.
A bell signals the end of morning recess at Buenos Aires' Technical School number 28. A group of 16 and 17-year-olds head to a special class about voting. By election time, 35,000 kids are supposed to learn everything there is to know about the country's electoral system. But as can be the case with young people everywhere, lack of information may be less of a problem than apathy. 17-year-old Axel says he may vote, or he may not. In general, we're all lazy, he says. No one wants to get up early on a Sunday morning to go vote. But a remarkable number of Argentina's youth, 75% of those eligible, say they will get up on Sunday, October 27th, and it's not even a presidential election year. It seems a whole lot of teens feel they can make a difference on issues important to them. Damian Mas is 16 years old.
Everyone contributes their little grain of sand to make the huge number of votes. What's important is that we're interested and we vote. The country depends on our votes.
Damian plans to vote for President Kirchner's Front for Victory party in October.
I like how they're running the country, how the country is evolving. I like how education has evolved and how many more schools they've built. I also like that youth can vote. That's very good. I like the universal cash payments to poor families with children.
Across town, in Buenos Aires' National High School, 17-year-old Ricardo Arraga is also excited about going to the polls.
I'm going to try to make the revolution. I mean, maybe you can't change the situation, but you have to try.
Like Damian Mas, Arraga is focused on education, though he's not as excited about the government's record. He says a better educational system would be the solution to Argentina's high crime rate. But regardless of which party kids plan to vote for, Arraga says he understands why his peers are expending so much energy learning and talking about the elections.
They see this right like a tool for making a change in the society. Feel more important, like, oh, my opinion matters.
This kind of sentiment is music to Mariano Heller's ears. Heller is a law professor at the University of Buenos Aires and one of the many instructors of the voting class. He says the class doesn't push any particular candidates, political parties, or issues. The goal is just to get kids involved.
The little grain of sand we each contribute helps strengthen democracy, which is something we have to take care of every day because Argentina has had a strong authoritarian tradition. Democracy is like a little plant that we have to water daily.
Some Argentines aren't terribly happy about granting 16-year-olds the right to vote. They view the reduced voting age as a ploy by President Kirchner's Front for Victory party to grab votes. But while young people might make a difference, their vote likely won't swing the election. They represent only about 2% of the country's eligible voters. Yet they still plan to show up in droves. For The World, I'm Eilish O'Neill in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Argentina, you may remember, is one of many countries still fuming at the U.S. about the NSA. Yep, the National Security Agency monitored their communications, too. We're going to explore a different aspect of the NSA's vast operation now. It's the gigantic data storage facility that the agency is building out in Utah. The opening of this Utah data center has been delayed, though, by significant electrical problems. The problems are still under investigation, so no one knows the cause quite yet. The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Gorman is on the story. First of all, give us an idea, Siobhan, of the size of the Utah data center.
Well, it's the space is 1 million square feet. More than 1 million square feet. The part that will house the data is roughly 100,000 square feet, with 900,000 square feet of space for support for things like the electrical infrastructure.
I don't even know whether they have a word to describe how big the Utah data center is. How do you measure its size of data?
Well, that's tough because no one will actually share that information. But when you talk with outside experts who kind of look at the parameters of the facility, so to speak, they say that it will probably hold exabytes or even zettabytes of data. And an exabyte, just to give you a little perspective, is 100,000 times the amount of printed material in the Library of Congress. And a zettabyte is 1,000 times that.
Holy smokes. Okay, so that's the size of the Utah data center. What are these electrical problems they're experiencing?
Well, one project official described it to me as a bolt of lightning in a 2-foot box. There have been these explosions, sometimes fiery explosions, that have happened 10 times in the last 13 months on the facility's electrical infrastructure, and obviously just makes it very difficult to do things like plug your computers in, because these are highly sensitive computer systems that are going to go into this data center, and they need very reliable electricity.
You know, I've heard about big data farms starting to sprout up in Northern Europe because the low temperatures help keep those massive servers mm-hmm. cool. But well, the NSA building out in the desert of Utah, I mean, I know it can get cool, but isn't it usually hot? Why'd they do that?
Well, they did it because it's a source of both abundant and cheap electricity. You know, there are also people who say that having the support of Senator Orrin Hatch at the time was also quite helpful moving it through. But the primary reason was really because of the abundance of the electricity there.
I mean, it's abundant and cheap, but if it's unreliable, is that any good for the NSA?
Well, the unreliability is a problem with the structure, not with the electrical service. So the irony of this is that they built it in a place where they would have enormous access to electricity, and yet their own infrastructure is making it difficult to take advantage of that.
Now, you're right. There have been 10 meltdowns in the last 13 months. Does the NSA have any idea, or are they saying why this is happening?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers is overseeing the building, and the building is being put together by a joint venture of three contractors. And there has been a fair amount of disagreement among officials on the project over what the cause is, whether or not they've actually found the cause. The contractor in the last couple of weeks came forward and said that they found the cause, but investigators with the Army Corps of Engineers say that that theory is unproven. And so they're 13 months into it and don't have agreement about what the cause of these electrical failures is, except for in two instances. So they know what caused two of the electrical failures, but eight remain mysterious.
And do they say when they think they'll be able to solve the problem?
They don't know. I mean, they've been trying for more than a year to try to figure this out. And there's enormous pressure on NSA to get this center up and running because they see it as absolutely critical to their mission, as they put it. And while, again, they won't describe exactly what they're doing with the center, it's obviously going to store enormous amounts of data. And the fact that NSA feels a lot of pressure to get this thing up and running suggests that they need space to put the surveillance data that they're collecting.
Yeah. Remind us what sort of data they're collecting that requires like sizes up into the possibly zettabytes.
Well, NSA collects a whole host of things. And, you know, while we don't know the specifics of what will go into this exact data center, I mean, they collect conversations. They may collect videos. They may collect just data about transactions and communications. But they're doing it on such a scale globally that even small data that comes in small packages aggregated together becomes quite large.
And without the Utah data center online, what does this mean in terms of the NSA's ability to monitor whatever they're monitoring?
Well, I mean, they're certainly still able to monitor it, but the question of how much they can keep, you know, becomes a bigger and bigger issue the longer this gets delayed.
The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Gorman, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, before we take a break, a quick note on Woody Allen's latest film, Blue Jasmine. It's screening all over the world, but not in India anymore. Woody halted its release to movie theaters there. He objected to how his film was affected by India's wide-ranging anti-smoking campaign. The law mandates that if a movie character lights up, an anti-tobacco warning must appear at the bottom of the screen. That's intended to counter scenes where characters glamorize smoking. Woody Allen thought the on-screen warning detracted from his work. Huh. I wonder what Humphrey Bogart would have made of this one. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Giant killer hornets terrorize parts of northern China. That headline seems straight out of a bad sci-fi horror flick, but it's real. Attacks by the biggest hornets you'll ever see have actually killed more than 40 people in China in the last 3 months. Hundreds have been injured. We turn to Justin Schmidt, an entomologist at the University of Arizona, to help us understand this story. I asked him to start by describing the giant hornets themselves.
They are the world's largest stinging insect. They get about 2 inches or 5 centimeters for the queens, and they're bright orange with a huge, stocky head. So rather intimidating wasps.
Right, and what have you heard about the reaction when people get stung by these?
Well, when you get stung by something that big, that's that noisy and that painful, you know, naturally it's going to be very hard to keep your composition and, you know, just act as if, oh, well, this is just another day. You know, you tend to find it a very traumatic experience.
Now, one of the reasons we wanted to speak with you, Justin, is that you're the creator of something called the Schmidt Pain Index, and you've endured lots of nasty stings from insects in your research to devise this pain ranking. Tell us about it.
Well, basically, I was a graduate student, and I wanted a way to evaluate one sting compared to another. And we have toxicity, which is easy to measure, but we had no way to figure out how much the actual impact of the pain was. And pain, of course, is the first thing you encounter and perhaps the most effective of a defense. So we developed a pain scale pretty much so we could measure one stinging insect against another.
Back to those giant hornets from China, they are not on your Schmidt Pain Index, but I've seen the images, and, I mean, they look like gunshot wounds. Do you have any sense of, based on those pictures, how they might kind of work their way onto your index?
Yeah, I would predict if I were stung by one, it'd probably be about a 3 out of the highest 4 on the scale. And the reason is that I've been stung by the bullet ants, which are 4. They're the highest. And they hurt and cause trembling and throbbing and piercing deep pain and numbing for up to 12 hours, sometimes even more than that. And I've been stung by a number of relatives of the hornets. They're slightly smaller, and their stings are nowhere near, you know, that severe. That said, the size of the hornets, you know, compensates for that, so that's why I would put it at a good solid 3 if I had to predict. But like you said, I haven't actually been stung by one of those for better or for worse.
Well, whether it's a 3 or a 4, I mean, it sounds pretty darn unpleasant. Do we need to worry about giant killer hornets attacking North America?
Not really. We have the European hornet, which is about 2/3 the size, and it's a very docile species. Most people will see one and they kind of taken aback. Wow, that's a big hornet. But other than that, very few people get stung by them.
Justin Schmidt, entomologist and creator of the Schmidt Pain Index for insect stings. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, some music from an African country we don't often hear from, Mauritania. But Noura Mint Semali wants to change that. Her music mixes older Mauritanian music with blues and rock, and she's taken it around North Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. She was just in the U.S. for her first tour here. Bruce Wallace caught up with her in New York City.
One time, a long time ago, the story goes, there was a Mauritanian igao, or griot, someone from a traditional music and storytelling family. He's giving the king and his court a music lesson, explaining the various moods that Mauritanian music can elicit. Jaysh Oul Shigali, himself a griot, picks up the story. My music can make you feel love, the griot tells the king, demonstrating that mood. The people gathered feel the love. My music can make you laugh or cry, he continues. Laughter, then tears fill the room. It can make you feel like fighting, he says, and the tension rises. And it can make you relaxed. The next day, the king asks the griot what happened to him last night. You fell asleep, so I took off, the griot says. Shigali and his wife Noura Mint Semali apparently left the sleepy mode at home when they came for their first U.S. tour. They played in Brooklyn last week and quickly had the crowd swaying and dancing. Semali, like her husband, comes from one of Mauritania's premier griot families. Her father wrote an authoritative book on the country's music, and her stepmother, who Semali started singing with when she was 13, was one of the few Mauritanian musicians to gain an international following. Seymily takes this heritage seriously, seeing it as her calling to tell the rest of the world about her country's music. It's not always an easy task. It doesn't have nearly the international stature that music from neighboring countries like Senegal, Mali, and Algeria has. She thinks that's partially because of a lack of government investment in the arts. It may also be related to geography. Mauritania bridges Arab North Africa and Sub-Saharan West Africa, and the music takes in healthy pieces of both regions, but it doesn't fall fully into either world. Seymily's music also, obviously, bridges past to present. The band's last album is called Azawan, the word for the traditional ensemble in Mauritanian music. Shigali's winding guitar takes up the role the tidnit would play in a traditional Mauritanian griot group, and a Western drum kit replaces hand drums. The lyrics are a mix, too. Songs about traditional Mauritanian food share space with ones about environmental awareness and breast cancer. But Seymily says that her heart is in tradition, particularly when she's touring the U.S. She wants to present a pure picture of the music of her country, even if she funks it up here and there. Being hard to classify isn't necessarily bad. For one thing, it's meant some pleasantly eclectic billings for the group. They shared the stage in Brooklyn with a young improvising drummer and a guitarist who's a longtime stalwart of the city's experimental music scene. Listening backstage, Seymily smiled curiously and said she liked it. "What do you call this music?" she asked in French. "Avant-garde," a bandmate told her. Her adventures in American culture also took her to Louisville, Kentucky, home to a large Mauritanian expat community. "Has she found any American food she likes?" I asked. "She loves fried chicken," she says. Back in Brooklyn, the band's closing song marches forward with a heavy, funk backbeat. The crowd is on its feet. They've blown through the venue's 10 p.m. curfew, so an encore is not in the cards. In Mauritania, their shows can go on for a long time. Here, the neighbors complain. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, Brooklyn.
You can see Noura Mint Seymily performing a pretty unusual instrument. I don't even know what it's called. We have that on video at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.